Lovely. Cheers all round. All right, here we go. Okay. Welcome, everybody, to episode 26 of That Roundnet podcast. Today, all the boys are here, Mike, myself, and Thomas. And today, we are very, very excited to have on a guest that we've been planning on having on for quite a long time now. And that is the original inventor of the sport that we know and love. And that is Jeff Nurek. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Glad it only took 26 episodes to get me on. So,
well, if we're honest, it sort of took a season and 26 episodes because this is season two.
Okay.
Your name has been on the list obviously for a long time for us. We have plenty of guests that we want to get on the podcast. It's always, you know, hard to find the right time, but with this week being the week before the championship in the US, and then obviously us reviewing that episode, and then sort of the season coming to a conclusion, it's a nice time to bring you on to give a bit more insight into your mind and the sport of roundnet that many people are maybe not that familiar with. So on that note, I think it's best let's draw back to the very beginning. So many people are not maybe too familiar with your name and understanding of your role within the sport. So if we take it all the way back from when you was first, I mean, you're still a toy inventor now, but your role in regards to when you first came up with the idea of the sport was when you was creating several different toys. And this initial idea spurred from what I believe was a fun toy that you also played with as a kid, a baseball net. Would you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, so a little bit more of my background. I went to the University of Michigan for college and studied industrial design. And my knowing when I was in school that I had to design something when I got out, and what job did I want to have? I found out that toy inventing was an actual job that people got paid to do. As opposed to working for a toy company like a Hasbro or a Fisher-Price or Mattel, the idea that you could work and come up with new ideas and get paid in royalties, that really appealed to me. And after a trip to Chicago with my classmates and stuff, I found out that Chicago was the capital of toy inventing. And so I had every intention of, when I graduated from school, to go work for a company called Marvin Glass, which was the biggest and most successful toy inventing company in the world. And, you know, things like Mousetrap and Operation and Light Bright, all these things that I played with growing up came from this studio. And so my intention was to work for them, but long story short, I found out they were imploding as a company, and all the partners from that company were opening up their own little toy inventing firms around Chicago. And I ended up getting a job for one of those firms. And my boss, Sam Catone, was his godson invented the game Operation. And so, and these people, the other two people that I worked with, were all ex-Marvin Glass employees. And so I got all their stories and all their knowledge of being a toy inventor. And my job was to use those skills that I had at school by doing prototypes and art boards and presenting and come up with ideas just constantly. And that's all we did. And so one of those, we had brainstorming meetings once or twice a week. And for one of them, I came in there with the idea that I really wanted to do something with a pitchback net. Now, I grew up with a pitchback net, and it's basically a vertical net that you would throw a baseball at, and the baseball would bounce off and you'd catch. And you'd be able to play catch by yourself, or if you put the little ribbons in the middle of this rectangle, you'd have a strike zone that you could practice your pitching and, you know, try to get accuracy in that. And I just thought, something's got to be done with that. And so I mentioned it in one of our brainstorming meetings, and we were a block away from Toys R Us. So I went over to Toys R Us, bought one, and just put myself in a room and started playing around with what is this? What can I do with it? Eventually put it horizontally off the ground and started bouncing stuff off of it. And there was something there, you know, you could kind of visualize a volleyball or a bouncing type game. But as I played and tried to come up with some rules and stuff, the rectangle was not working for me. I just felt trying to stay on a side it was kind of not fun. So I eventually got a hula hoop and put that same net around the hula hoop and raised it off the ground and started bouncing stuff. And then the idea that, okay, we have a bouncing game here, tried all these different size balls and realized that having a line that you had to stay on your side made no sense. So we're having a 360 game now. And coming up with rules, I tried 2-on-2 volleyball rules and it just made sense. Okay, you're serving it into the net. The other team has up to 3 tries to get it back in the net. And it's like, it just flowed. It totally made sense. And got, you know, played it as much as you can in an office building and knew it was a good game. So it came up with the artboard, had the prototype, sent it out to the world to see what they thought. And eventually the company, Tomy, thought it was good enough to buy. And Tomy is a huge toy company. And to this day, they're still a large toy company. But they had never done outdoor games before. And so that was interesting. And that was in 1989 that I came up with it. So in the toy fair in 1990, so in February 1990, I went to toy fair and went to the toy building, which was right there on 5th Avenue, 23rd and Broadway in New York, and walked into the Tomy showroom. And there was my game. My first game ever to make it to market was Spikeball. And they had the commercial running on televisions behind it. And they had the models. They always have models who, you know, want to explain to you how it's played and what it is. And it was very exciting. And the year it came out, when we're all excited and I see it on the shelves at Toys R Us and, you know, and at that time Kmart and there was no Targets or anything, but, you know, you think, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. And it was a summer of 50 degrees Fahrenheit everywhere across the United States. And no one was buying outdoor toys. Although the commercial was on MTV, they had an MTV spring break tournament that was on. And so it was, you know, you keep being optimistic. And I, you know, at the time I think I was 23 years old and my friends and I played it all the time. We played it on North Avenue Beach where right now, I'm sure if you went down North Avenue Beach, it's being played there. And I went to played it at Belmont Harbor where I lived, and I loved playing it. We played a lot of Spikeball, and after about 3 years on the market, it didn't sell enough, and Tomy's like, okay, we're done. And so, and at that point in time, probably was 92, I had left the company that I invented it for and went on to become a, you know, creative director at another toy company, and then went on my own and created my own company. So That's the initial story of Spikeball.
I think there's so many good aspects within inside sort of that story and history. I think just the fact, again, going from a baseball, what did you call a pitcher net?
Pitchback.
Yeah. Pitchback net. I mean, again, it's just a foreign language to Europeans. But then putting that on the floor and going from a rectangle to a hula hoop and circular. I think the question that fascinates me a lot is when you was originally first making the concept and you was obviously going through different prototypes, what made you decide that, you know, 8 inches off the floor was the right height? What made you decide that 36 inches in diameter was the one you was going for? What made you and the ball that you used when you first made it? I mean, obviously you have no idea it is now and today, and we have these thoughts and questions about how, you know, these small inches and centimeters can change the game. But what made you sort of settle on that initial sort of measurements when you first created the sport?
Nothing. Totally arbitrary. Just, you know, any higher, it would be a little weird. I mean, I think the 8 inches is, it was just where it got sent out at 8 inches. And the ball, I mean, I played with a lot of different balls. And I think that grapefruit softball size ball just felt like the right size. 36 inches, that's probably what the size of the hula hoop that I bought was. I mean, that's not, there's no great science. And it's so funny to have, you know, we're trying to standardize the sport, obviously, as you all are. And so 36 inches works, you know, and 8 inches works. I've, you know, I, the 12 inch the Mammoth set. I've played on it. I've seen it. It changes things, but you know, that's if people want to play with 12 inches off the ground, and who am I to say that, you know, because I don't have any great science. I'm not going to say, do you know how long I plant, you know, I spent thinking about 8 inches? No, that's, it's just the way
it is. You did like 4 years of research and Tommy's like, just get this to market. And you're like, yeah, the implications in 20 years, the cuts are, you know, we got to
get
having a distance. Come up a different way. We got to be ready. Yeah.
No. Tommy wanted to make sure that it retailed at $19.99. So that means they probably manufactured it for like $3.50, and then by the time you do all the multiplications and stuff, so it's, you know, it was what it was. I mean, I still love, you know, I still have the original ball, although I think I poked the when I tried to inflate it once, I shoved the thing in there, so it's kind of a squishy ball. But you know, this was smooth as it gets and had the print, you know, the print of the logo on it. It is what it is, but
I was going to confirm. Did it cost $20 when it retailed in was it 1990?
Yeah, it retailed, I think, in 1999 or in 1970.
I just want to share that the equivalent is $45 today.
Yeah.
For people wondering. Yeah. Which I think is like, you know, probably what you would expect. Yeah.
But
I thought that's curious.
But if I go to Menards right now or go to, you know, any of these stores or Target, I can get the $20 version still.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Yep. You know, it's a perceived value. And I mean, there is no better name than Spikeball. I'm very proud. Don't ever say I invented Round Net, because I did not invent Round Net. That's a that's a made up name. Spikeball is the best name ever. It's what I called it. And I refuse to call it Round Net because that doesn't make any sense to me. So
how did you come up with a Spikeball? Because when you think about the name, it's like the spike in it. For me, as a non-English native, it doesn't make too much sense for me, but it's a very nice word that you came up with. But how did you get to that? Like, the ball doesn't have spikes in it.
Well, but the whole the activity of hitting the ball like that, the spiking was, you know, since I got it from a volleyball, you know, and spiking in volleyball is inherent. That's a term of using and hitting it, you know, with projection in a certain direction, so you're spiking the ball constantly, so calling it spike ball just made, you know, it made sense to me. Like volleyball, you're volleying, you know, basketball, you're basketing. I don't know, but
were there any other prototype names?
No, I think spike ball was
pretty
just
quick, and
it just rolls off your tongue. It's like, it's spike ball, and I think it's descriptive, and it's it always made sense to me to do that. So
How do you feel when, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, so the sport to grow and it now, you know, as it being called, well, you know, as it being a sport now and being called Round Net as the official, you know, sporting name, how does that make you feel in regards to when people reference it and talk about it as Round Net? Because I think, again, it's, you know, so many people, because for you, Spikeball has a very different meaning to most people, because Spikeball to you is your creation, the sport, right, the equipment that you created for the sports then become something. As other people, as you know, as we know, Spikeball now refers to Spikeball Inc., the company that obviously we're going to discuss later on the podcast. But it's like, and then if you have RoundNet now, who, you know, people now refer to as a sport, and for it to grow, you need to now move away from an independent manufacturer such as Spikeball Inc. and refer to it as the common known name of RoundNet. So how where does sort of all of that sit with you in regards to when it was released that, you know, RoundNet is the generalized name for the sport, and Spikeball, you know, is now referred to as a independent manufacturer of that sport. So how does that all sit with you, despite obviously creating Spikeball was the original invention?
I don't know. I mean, it just seems so forced to call it RoundNet. And, you know, as I talk to you players and that, I mean, that's, I don't, you know, there's a general agreement that RoundNet is not a good name. And the implication is that this sport where you hit it onto a surface and have up to three tries to get it back in, it with the word net in the sport's name, I think you're not selling the whole gameplay short, as we see from like Revol. You know, they're playing spike ball game on a hard surface. why can't the name, the game of spikeball or round net, it doesn't have to be played on a net. I mean, a flat surface raised 8 inches off the ground with a 36-inch diameter is a whole other surface you play on, just like in tennis. You play on a clay court or grass court or, you know, or asphalt, but it's still tennis. So why can't spikeball be played on a hard surface or a soft surface and different surfaces and still have the same rules? So I think calling it round net kind of is a stopper of the potential for the future of the sport. So that's, I just don't think it needs to be played on a net.
I'm not in massive disagreement, although I do very much believe that there needs to be a name for the sport, and the sport cannot be continued to be referred to as spikeball. That's, again, my personal opinion, because, again, too many people's references then to a manufacturer, and for the sport to grow, we need several manufacturers, and we also need a name for the sport. Otherwise, it's just going to become monopoly well, with, as the sport continues to grow.
I guess my hope is that eventually becomes the Kleenex, and it becomes a generic name that overrides the name of the company. Because since I'm not involved with the company, I could really care less about about the company having its trademark, you know, taken over by everybody calling it the name that everybody associates with the sport. So that's just me being selfish. I understand exactly what you're saying. It does need a sport does need a name. I just don't know if Roundnet's the best name for it.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's totally reasonable that, like, spikeball is the best name. It's unfortunate from the perspective that, like, that has become a company over a generic sport name, where it could help it going forward. And it may not, right? It may be Roundnet, but there's also the case that, like, that if the decision was made or it hadn't existed, that spikeball would be a great sport name.
Yeah.
Irregardless, which I agree. It just makes sense. Yeah.
As a nice transition onto our next topic, if we discuss now more about, or we fast forward a few years, and now we get a little bit more into the sort of relationship slash, you know, the beginning of the communication between Spikeball Inc. and yourself. So fast forward, it was around 2005, 2006, 2005?
Yeah, 2005.
That then what? I mean, out of the blue, again, many people were not so informed, including myself, about the details in regard to this topic. But of course, it's been now 12 years since then. There hasn't really been any fruition or continuation of the spikeball with you and the industry that Tommy, sorry, you said, that's then producing and trying to market this set. What then happened within those 12 years from them stopping producing and marketing the set to 2005, when you then had initial conversations slash discussions with Chris, who obviously now is the CEO of Spikeball Inc.
So, so I had, you know, obviously had been gone from my initial company working for Sam, but always had a relationship with him because he was just the nicest father figure that, you know, gave me my first job. And so in 2005, Chris and his other partners were able to find out through my biography online, because at that point in time, I started becoming a syndicated cartoonist and puzzle creator. And so I had biographies and abilities to find out who I was. And on that biography was the inventor of Spikeball. And so they reached out to me, having found that out themselves, and said, "Hey, what's going on with Spikeball? Do you have any extra sets? We love the game. We've played and we've ruined all our sets, and we're wondering if we can get a few extra." And at that point, I said, "Well, no, because I've, you know, the half dozen or so that I have, I'm keeping because I, you know, collect my inventions." And they said, "Well, is it going to be manufactured again?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. That's a really good question. Let me find out." And I reached out to Sammy and said, "Hey, what's going on with Spikeball, Sam?" And he told me, "I'm showing it right now," and he told me the companies that had it. And one of the companies was right here in Indianapolis, where I'm from, who Fundex, who had a lot of outdoor games at the time, and made sense to me that he was showing it to them. And so I reported back to Chris and said, "Look, as far as I know, it's, you know, my old boss told me that he's showing it to real companies, and, you know, I was hoping that it would go out." And after you know, several months, they reached back and say, hey, is it going, you know, is it going forward? And I reached out to Sam again. He said, yeah, as far as I know. And so I, that was my report to them. And they're like, well, a few of us are thinking that we'd like to have it made. I'm like, well, I'll see what happens with this. And if not, we can talk. But, you know, with the caveat that Chris imposed, you know, lets me know that none of us have any experience in manufacturing, marketing, or sporting equipment. So, okay, that doesn't exactly, you know, motivate me to work out a deal with a bunch of people that don't have any background in this. But I said, you know, let's keep in touch. And then I think Chris and I had at least a couple phone conversations, and I told him exactly what I'm telling you. I'm, you know, if they were going to do it, I was going to be the middleman and work out, you know, this product that I love so much and help Sammy, who I love, get his royalty payment. I'd figure out where I'd get paid in the whole thing, and someone would, you know, like them could make it. So they didn't. The next thing I know is I've reached out to him and said, look, let me know if I can do something. This needs to be made, because Sammy wasn't getting anywhere. And I never heard back from him. And next thing I know, a few years later, Spikeball was coming out without me. So
in regards to all of this, so the again, just to sort of paraphrase, the initial conversation went in the way of Chris, along with potentially some friends, was reaching out to wonder where they could get more Spikeball sets. And yes, that's when, within this 12 stint period of not really selling many sets, or not really, you know, being a big priority for you within your life, the you then researched where they were being sold. They were being sold in a store near you. You obviously forwarded that information onto Chris.
The idea, the invention of Spikeball was being shown to manufacturers. Hmm. So, because, you know, as inventors, the whole premise is that you don't manufacture it. You find companies that have that and they pay you a royalty. So Sammy was presenting it to another company, you know, for royalties.
On your behalf. So you then, yes. Okay.
Well, on his behalf. I mean, because in the beginning, I was work for hire for Sam. You know, even though I invented it, there was three of us, and my job was to come up with ideas. And Sammy was just his own person at that time. He had his own, just himself and a friend. And so I was going to hopefully be the go-between, because I was not going to screw Sam out of something that he initially paid me to come up with. So I was going to be a go-between between a potential group like Chris's group and Sam, and try to broker a deal where we could all be happy. Sammy would get paid, I get paid, and they could make it, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was the initial goal. I've listened to Chris's version of the story, and he, you know, found it confusing that I would involve my old boss, and found out from his attorney that the trademark was not being used, which it wasn't, and we had not initially patented it, which usually when you're an inventor, the manufacturer you're working with, it takes care of getting things patented, because it's in their best interest to have that protection. But Tomy didn't bother, because it just, you know, why would they bother at that point in time? They'd be the first one and the only one out with this idea. And if it were to take off, they probably would have, you know, eventually gotten a patent on it. So
yeah,
did they not initially, because they were waiting to see how the sets would perform in the market? Is that also common with inside the toy industry, of waiting until to see if there is success until the item is patented?
Yeah, I think they want to, you know, when you're the only one coming out with a unique idea, you're not really worried about someone infringing, you know, where sometimes when you have a mechanism, you want to patent it to make sure no one steals your mechanism. Like if you're doing a super soaker idea, you'd certainly want to patent that technology so everybody can't take that unique thing. But I think a net strung over a round surface with a ball bouncing over it, you're not going to get much more than a design patent. You're not getting a mechanical patent, because there's nothing unique mechanically about that. It's more the design and look. And that they probably would have done retroactive if it would have taken off, and they just want to have a little bit more protection. So, and you know, and this, they had the name Spikeball trademarked until it was no longer in market. And then if you want to hold on to a trademark name like that, you would either have to say we have the intention of bringing it to market, And you can do that for a period of a year and a half, 2 years, and keep paying the trademark office to hold on to it. But you eventually have to use it. You can't just hoard names, you know, that you want to keep unless you're actually going to market with.
No, I mean, there were
unlike URLs, yes, sir.
I think there were a lot of tries to kind of copyright every kind of market name that people not using at the moment, and then sell it back to the companies that would like to use it. So that the rule makes sense, probably. But I think also in your case, you were, to sum it up, it was your idea. You were the creator. You were selling the idea to a further customer in this case, or company. And they did not make the trademark because they probably, I mean, at the time it was, you said 1989, probably they also didn't feel the urge because not everything was as fast as it now, because when I now look up company names on the internet, I can see in a few seconds.
It's a whole new world. It is a whole new world. And that's obviously, if I would have had social media back in 1990 when it came out, this would be a whole different discussion, I think. And obviously,
100%.
That is, I think, one of the things that has fueled Spikeball. It's such a fun game to watch, you know, watch the highlights and watch the plays online, that sharing your, you know, when I watch you all with your GoPros, filming your game, when you see that highlight and that rally or that insane serve, it's fun to share and people like to watch it. And that's, I think, really, you know, my timing was bad. You know, if it would have been in the 2000s, 2010s, my invention, I mean, what I saw as a great game and what it has become would have happened under my watch, as opposed to how it's happened now without me.
A couple of things to build off on that is when it got sort of dropped by Tommy, the initial the company who was taking you on board, what were your feelings / your mindset towards the idea? Obviously, you're a toy inventor. You're creating, you know, 101 thoughts and ideas are going around your head every day in regards to ideas that potentially come to concept or come to a prototype. When this sort of didn't have as much success initially as you hoped, did you sort of just put in the back of your mind? Was there sort of some still attachment to this idea? Because again, you're coming up with so many ideas over such a short period of time. How did you initially react to that?
Spikeball has always been the one idea that I love the most. I mean, out of the hundreds of ideas that I have and have come up with, I think Spikeball is the one I always knew would be, if I was ever to put my own money behind something, Spikeball would be that. As opposed to behind me is my storage room on the other side of this wall with all my prototypes for other games that are just great games, but I wouldn't go spending money doing that. So, you know, to have someone come up to me and say, hey, we love this game. It's like, yeah, I love this game too. And it should be made. And that was always, you know, my mentality was this game should be huge. So to see it where it's at right now, I feel, you know, redemption in that idea that I did know this was a pure sport. It didn't have any gimmicks, didn't have any batteries, didn't have any lights. Well, until it's light bright or whatever. But it was, to me, it was the purest idea that I have ever come up with. So, you know, but there's, you know, in my life cycle, 2005, when Chris approached me, I had a, you know, 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. So my, you know, I was just trying to make a living and try to keep my house going and try to keep my marriage going and all that fun stuff. So, you know, I can't, if I spend too much time on one idea, I'm ignoring all the other ideas. So it's, you know, it is what it is. I was glad that there was interest. And that's why when my old boss was telling me that he had interest in it, I was happy, you know. And I'm sure at that point in time, he would have included me on it because he knew where that idea came from.
Yep, very understandable. So of course, very much a balance, such as you mentioned, of other things as well as the ideas you have. So fast forwarding on to 2005, again, we discussed the sort of initial contact and relationship with Chris. So within those sort of 2 years or, you know, time period between initial contact and then the Spikeball then coming to the market of this, you know, company that yeah, again, you wasn't known or didn't know too much about, what was the situation within this period? So from initial contact, you said you had a couple of phone calls and then there was no contact at all. Did you ever then go to approach or reach out again back to Chris to get an understanding of where they were at? Did you just assume that they'd have dropped the idea due to their potential, you know, lack of experience and understanding within the, you know, the market, marketing side and sports manufacturing goods? Where was your sort of mindset at in regards to that time period?
Yeah, well, I mean, my last email to Chris was, hey, let me know what I can do. We need to make, you know, if you guys want to do something, let me know. I'll help you figure it out, you know, because I offered my expertise and, you know, the fact that I was a designer and the inventor of this idea, but didn't hear back from. So I just assumed that, like I said, their lack of experience would have left them without, you know, that they would have found out what so many inventors who don't do this professionally find out, how difficult it is to bring something to market. So it wasn't until several years later that I saw that they spikeball.com was taken and there was an idea. And then lo and behold, even farther down the line, I'm watching Shark Tank one night after dinner and there is Spikeball on it. And I see, you know, Mark Cuban asking, you know, did you invent this? And they're like, no, it's just the internet, you know, the intellectual property had fallen to the side and been laying there. We got all the trademark and the patent and everything, and we're coming out with it. So that was disappointing that, you know, here I'm seeing my idea, but then, you know, I'm not part of this idea that I love so much. So and up to this day, it's a very, you know, it's a roller coaster of emotions for me, seeing how popular it is and feeling, you know, great about that, and seeing how many of you play it with so much passion and spend so much time with it. It's very humbling. And that would, you know, that should be the goal. But the entrepreneur in me is like, I really, really would have liked my, you know, royalty on this idea that I came up with. And so that's, you know, it's a give and take. But
I think everybody can relate to that.
Yeah, I hope so. Because, you know, I'm human. I have an ego and I'm a professional inventor. So I have pride, you know, so to not get paid for it, for your idea, is kind of a tough pill to swallow. But, you know, I just keep moving on, keep doing what I'm doing. So,
well, not just I think it's also not just the paid and monetary value. It's also the lack of understanding, as we sort of previously mentioned, of people not knowing the origin of where the sport came from. Because that I think, if anything, that may hurt as much or even than the monetary or lack of monetary value you received.
I remember being on the golf course once with doing a, like, some charity, you know, four player thing. And I had, halfway through the round, I had someone ask me what I did. And I said, I was a cartoonist and a toy inventor. And like, oh, what things have you invented? And I said, well, I mentioned Spikeball. Like, no, I know the inventor of Spikeball. And they're like, well, no. And like, who? And they mentioned Chris, because they had friends in Chicago. And I'm like, no, let me set that straight. So when someone is adamant that I'm not the inventor, that's kind of disappointing. So
I think the more the people are involved with the sport and the overall surroundings, as me and Scott and Mike, for sure, people know the story. But like, as casual as they get or as further away from the core, I think people will not know. And I think that's also a part of a lot of sports, that a lot of people forget who were actually inventing those sports that they play now. And I'm pretty sure that, especially when we think about soccer, I would not know who invented soccer. It just, it got its own thing. So it's kind of losing this connection. But for you, it's really close, because it's not that far, not that long ago.
Yeah, and I'm not going away. I still am involved with the sport, and I'm still wanting to have my moment. You know, I'm sitting here, and behind me, I won't show you, as I have lots of Spikeball inventions and round net inventions, if you will, that I'm equipment and things that I'm working on that I hope to come out with under my brand Club Spike here in the next 12 months or so.
And
that's a very good thing, because we just have the next point.
That's also some very big news, because obviously a lot of people may be wondering and questioning, you know, what is your involvement within the sport right now? How much do you look to get involved? How much free time do you put into the sport? Do you still manage to sort of go to events and stay updated with you know, this invention that you once created now getting bigger and bigger each year. So sort of on that note, how involved are you now on a competition standpoint? Do you manage to watch much, go to events? How often are you following and keeping updated with the current RoundNet sort of scene and events?
Well, my way of keeping myself involved over the last several years has been through this brand Club Spike, and what it basically has been is selling t-shirts and working on designs, but it's been sponsoring teams. So I've been able to get to know great players like Chris Wilkins in Chicago and that whole Wyatt Semke group of the Midwest. I've got to know all the players and Thomas Hamilton and Ryan Marino and all these players and watch them and be in awe. But I've, you know, I've sponsored the Twins. I've sponsored, you know, Preston Buys. Sponsoring these great players who spend so much time, and I watch as much as I possibly can. I watch Thomas's broadcast when I can. I mean, I watch the Worlds. I watch you play in the Worlds last year. That was fun. And so I'm working all the time on it. But my day job is I'm an internationally syndicated cartoonist, and that takes precedence because that pays the bills, and I enjoy doing. You know, I somehow manage my life through being a inventor to become a cartoonist, and that's kind of a fun thing. But now I'm taking the time that I have in between drawing and designing. So right now my 3D printer is working right now, and I'm working on some prototypes. And I plan on, you know, I plan on my involvement in the sport to only grow in the next few years instead of dwindling. I really want to help grow this sport so it maybe one day can be an Olympic sport. So
yeah, that's I think that's really cool to hear on sort of that regard. How much can you share in regards to sort of the projects or plans you have envisioned and planning on for the next 12 months? Are we talking sort of accessories? Are we talking sets, ball? Are we talking, you know, other things in regards to outside the playing aspect around that? What sort of things can you share if you can share?
I mean, I'm trying. I have a line of products, and obviously a set is, you know, that's the golden ring for me, is to come up with the better set, because I'm always trying to improve upon my designs and improve upon my drawing skills. So I will have a set coming out. I'm working on that. And mm-hmm. hopefully it'll be bigger and better than what's out there. But, you know, I like the direction that some of the more serious sets are going, for sure. But accessories and training equipment, I'm working to really help players who want to take their play to the next level with some of these ideas. And I'm at the end of the day, I think you all find out about it when I'm ready, because I'm going to reach out and try to get a Kickstarter or some kind of, you know, group sponsorship to get it coming out with. Because the reality is that tooling costs money, and to get the first 1,000 sets or 1,000 pieces of the products made, I'd rather not sink all my money into it so that I can get onto the next idea. And so I'll get prototypes out there. I'll show people what I'm thinking, and, you know, and if you like it, you jump in and you buy some and help me out, and I'll still be part of it. But regardless, you know, I'm still sponsoring teams. I was at the major a month ago in Columbus, blown away at, you know, why. And that was a fun experience. I got to see so many of the best teams that are going to be playing next week in Philadelphia, and kind of get a little preview of what a great tournament it is going to be next week. And, you know, I'm just enjoy being around. I mean, Spikeball players and RoundNet players are such great people. I mean, the community you have is just beyond words. And I hope to go over to Europe and meet you, Thomas, and see you guys play over there. Cause I know Scott and all of you have such a great club mentality and so much fun over there. I'm going to hopefully figure out some time to go over there and see it played over there as opposed to here in the US.
If you ever are up to, I mean, I can host you.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm going to be in Europe in November visiting my son, who's got a semester in Florence right now, the poor guy. So I got to impede upon him for a little bit and see that. But I would love to, you know, and I will next year. I once again, I've had a tournament that I call the Inventors Cup. that's usually hosted by the Chicago group people, and we'll hopefully figure out a good date for that and get that announced here soon so people can plan on being there, because it's we've done an indoor tournament and it's been a lot of fun to host it and to meet all these players and that.
Yeah, I think just to add on what you mentioned earlier about, you said a potential line of products, I think that's one huge step that the sport is sort of very soon and ready to take in regards to more training equipment and accessories. We discussed previously on this podcast in regards to, once you buy a set, you know, it's a great thing. It's a great thing for the sport, but also a drawback for the sport. You buy a set and then you're done. You got your four people, you got your net, you got your balls, and you can't really buy too much accessories or additional equipment for the sport. And therefore, you know, there's sort of a very hard line in regards to how much now cash flow and how much money can now be circulating within the sport. Of course, as we become more and more of a sport, there will of course be more.
Yeah. And as a product designer and inventor, you know, I'm always trying to think of how do you improve things and how do you, you know, the set is one thing. I'll concentrate on the set, but my mind has led me to all these other products that I think are missing from the sport that I'm, when I introduce them, you'll see and you'll say, oh, that makes sense. My inventing skills have not diminished. And the fact that my mentality is like, if I really want to stay with the sport and be part of it, the best thing I can do for you and for me is to think of things that haven't been done yet. And that's what I'm going to try to come out with. And I'm closing in on it. And I'm going to hopefully, like I said, in the near future, you'll see the ideas that I've come up with, and hopefully you'll like them and help me out, and we'll keep moving, advancing the sport. And the worst thing is, you know, I'll push the other manufacturers like Spikeball Incorporated to get better, and the whole sport will get better because competition. Because right now I don't, you know, it's kind of a monopoly to speak of. And I think Premier Spike, you know, obviously is going to push Spikeball. But when you look at all the other brands, the $20 and $30 sets, they're not pushing anybody. And most of you players are not buying into those. You want more of a quality and a company that's going to help you, you know, enjoy the sport.
Yeah.
I think at this point, it's really like, as we see the development of the last few years, I think every supplier that comes to the sport, every new brand that comes to the sport is really only beneficial, because the more competition, the better it is for consumers. And that's all we are up for at the moment, I guess. And yeah, I'm very happy to hear that you're also working on new things to bring to the sport. And of course, if you have the original developer of the set, and then he brings something new, I think everybody's excited to see.
Well, that's what I'm counting on. Hopefully my history, my background makes you at least pay attention to what I'm coming up with a little bit more, and will help me, you know, help me get in there and you know, spend this time and really help enjoy the sport like I would like to, by being involved with it more and being recognized as the person who invented it. That would help. That would be great. But if not, I love watching y'all, and I'm very humbled by, you know, all that you guys do with the podcast and with the, you know, live streaming and all that. I really appreciate all your time and effort that you guys put out and towards this idea of mine.
Yeah, no, to back up on Tops is, I think so many people will be excited as you've shared those words and shared those thoughts with the RoundNet community. And I think a really nice way to end up or to conclude this podcast would be to sort of discuss a memory or a thought that you've sort of experienced throughout now your RoundNet life, Spikeball life, that's very is very much present in your mind of one of the more enjoyable experiences you've had with inside the sport.
Well, occasionally when I'll walk up to a group of players that are playing, and I was in Hawaii last year, my parents lived there, and walked up to a group of a dozen people with a Spikeball net next to it. I'm like, hey, aren't you guys going to play? And they're like, yeah, but we suck. And I'm like, all right. Well, I said, does someone want to at least play the inventor of the sport? And they looked at me like, what? I'm like, well, I invented this and I'd like to play. And they're, next thing you know, everybody's grabbing their phones, and they're like, you know, 2 seconds later, showing each other the phones, like, yeah, he's legit. It's him. And we all played, and you know, I like playing the sport, and all the stuff I'm thinking and planning isn't for me, because I'm an intermediate player at best. I like playing in sand because I can dive and look really cool and not hurt myself, but I enjoy playing. I just wish my serving was better. I'm pretty fairly good. Yeah, well, I'm fairly good at serving or setting. I've been at tournaments watching these players, and I'll be talking to like Thomas Hamilton and say, okay, Thomas, don't let up, serve to me. There's just no way. I couldn't even imagine. I don't even know how any of you return Thomas's serves. He's insane.
The answer is most don't.
He is Thomas. I mean, I realize that I'm asking one of the best servers in the sport to wow me, and there's no, you know, but I don't think I could return most of your serves as it is. But it's always fun introducing myself, because that's, you know, strokes my ego. Occasionally I need my ego stroke, but to see people who have so much fun, and, you know, I always get my phone lit up when people or friends of ours are on spring break or whatnot, sending me pictures of people playing on the beach next to them. And they enjoy telling people that they know the inventor of the sport. And it is a very fun and unique position that I always hoped I would be in. And now that I'm in it, I'm very, you know, humble and very proud of the fact that I did think of something that a lot of people love and a lot of people like to play.
Indeed.
Okay. Sorry, I'm back. I dropped for a second, I think.
Yep.
You were talking about my serves, I've heard.
Your serves? Yes, yes. You were the Thomas I was talking about.
No, just kidding. Okay. Whoa, hey. Calm down, Scotty. Calm down.
That was a very nice way to conclude the episode, Jeff. Not so much about your comment, Thomas, but definitely, Jeff, you put it very nicely. And I think on that note, we'll end episode 26 here. If you want to shout out anyone or anything, Jeff, know where people can follow you, or anything you'd like people to follow potentially, then feel free to shout it out now. The stage is yours.
Well, I mean, the Club Spike on Instagram is a good start, or Jay Knurek at Instagram. I usually keep my Instagram feed pretty innocuous, and clubspike.net will obviously start to come to life a little bit more here in the near future. So, you know, feel free to, anybody wants to write me and talk to me, it's Jeff@clubspike.net. I'm very accessible and very easy to reach. So, but I appreciate Scott, this and Thomas, and of course Mike, you know, who I've met before when he and Nora drove the Spike van for the first time to Indianapolis. I had them park in front of my house for the night because I did not like them staying on the south side of Indianapolis on their initial run. So it was good to see him again as well. So
lovely. Great. Awesome. Then on that note, we thank you all for listening. Make sure to follow us as well as Jeff on our social medias at That Round It Podcast on Instagram. You can also join our Facebook group to get early access to the podcast. On that note, thank you guys for listening, and see you guys next week.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.